The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
One way of thinking about human life, our human lives, is that it's multidimensional. That there are different dimensions, different levels, different things going on at the same time. Maybe something little bit like, you know, if you go for a walk, just to go for a walk, you get some fresh air, and just nice to walk. Someone asks you, what's the purpose of the walk? Well, just to go somewhere. Just to walk. But it could also be that you're just going for a walk, but you're also going someplace. You just happen to be going to the store to buy groceries, pick something up as well. The point is not to buy the groceries, the point is just to walk, for the walking's sake maybe. But still, you're also going someplace. It could be you're walking just for walking's sake, but as you walk, it connects you more with your neighborhood, and you feel, you know, you're not thinking about that so much, but you feel more connected to the place that you're at, and you get to know the trees and the birds and the neighbors, and you get to know things. It could be that you're just going for a walk, and going for the walk puts you through changes, takes you to new neighborhoods you've never been to, and it's kind of challenging to be that neighborhood, and you have to deal with your fear and being a frightening neighborhood, and you work with the fear and you come through the other side and you realize that you've kind of been changed by that experience. Or you can go for a walk explicitly to go buy groceries, or explicitly to go and learn about the neighborhood. You have an agenda and something you're going to do. And so what I'm trying to say is that you could have two or three or five different things happening at the same time with any endeavor. There might be the explicit purpose that you have, and there might be the associated aspects of it that maybe you weren't thinking about originally, but that come into play. So the same thing when we do a Buddhist practice, do a mindfulness practice, there might be the purpose we have for the practice, and then there's all the associated things that also come into play as well. Some people practice just to, very explicitly, the main purpose is not to get anything, but just to be in the present moment, to let the present moment unfold as it wants to unfold. It's kind of like, you know, like just going for a walk, just here and let things happen. And some people practice very explicitly to go somewhere in their practice. They want to develop their concentration. They want to develop their capacity for compassion or loving kindness, and so they work on that and develop it. And there's a kind of a goal and a purpose of what you're trying to get to. Some people are doing it not just to be in the present moment, but to get to know the neighborhood. And apparently it's a cliche, many people know, but I just heard about it recently. Someone said the cliche is, my mind's a dangerous neighborhood. I thought that was kind of cute. So, you know, to get to know the neighborhood, so we practice and we get to know ourselves. Some people are not so much in touch with their emotions, and so it's good to kind of get familiar with their emotional lives. Or some people are not so aware of their cognitive life, what they think and believe. And so you go into the neighborhood and you explore what the beliefs are and all that, and that's the intention. If you just go for a walk, if you're just sitting to be present, you might become aware of the neighborhood. If you sit to be present, you might put you through changes that develops your compassion, perhaps. It's not your intention, but what happens. So, like, for example, that's what happened to me. I did this Zen practice, in my early years of practice, which was a kind of a non-dual practice, just showing up and being present with things as they are. And to my surprise, my compassion developed. And you could see there was a journey of developing and opening to compassion over the years of Zen practice that for me. And so there's other thing going on. And so also I was learning about myself that was going on. So there's many different levels. And what I'd like to talk about today is the level or the way of looking at practice from the point of view that we're involved in a journey. And to be involved in a spiritual practice can be seen as being part of a journey that has a beginning and a middle and end. And some people find it very helpful to think of it as a journey because then it has a sense of purpose or sense of orientation, what it's about. Some people find the sense of a journey oppressive because it means that you have to get someplace that's different than where you are right now. And so that's, it's somehow something wrong about being present here. I like the word journey because coming from the French word for a day, a jour. And one of the things about the journey, as I understand it, it's how far you travel in one day. And how far do you travel in one day is up to you. You know, it's not like some set length of time or distance, and it's just different. Some days you walk very short distance, some days you can walk a long distance. But it's just perhaps, it's very, in my mind, the word journey is very respectful of the idea of each person goes in their own pace, each person does it in their own way. And you go as far or as short as is your journey of that particular sitting or that particular day or that particular month or that particular life that you have. But a journey involves going through changes. Something happens in the course of the journey. And I want to suggest, somewhat lightly, five different steps to a spiritual journey that we can take. And I don't think we want to kind of locked in that this is the only way of understanding spiritual life, a practice life, but it might be helpful to look at it from this vantage point of these five aspects of the journey. The first aspect begins with recognition that something is off. Something's not quite right. There's some possibility that things can be different than how they are now. I'm suffering, there's problems in the world, in my family, there must be something that's different than, that has more meaning than the life that I have right now. There's something, some people, something's off. And without that feeling that there's something off, something is, there generally isn't beginning of a spiritual practice. And so I think everybody who comes to engage in an ongoing spiritual practice or meditation practice has some sense that something's not quite right, something could be better. Some people, when they have that feeling, are focused on their suffering, the difficulty, and they're trying to fix it or get away from it or to heal it or solve it or find some new possibility, get away from something. Some people have more of a sense of they can see the light. They can see that they have intuition or a sense or a vision of what's possible. It's possible to live at peace. It's possible to live with love or compassion. It's possible to live a very different way. And they get a sense of that. And rather than kind of reacting away from their difficulty, they're more opening up towards something that they see as that can be a bigger part of their life. So with this sense of something is off and there's some sense of possibility that things can be different is kind of the beginning of this. And then the next step of the journey is to decide to do something about it, to make a choice to not continue life as usual. Because life as usual is not working well enough. And so, I remember when I was a new Zen student, the teaching in a sense was, let go of all your goals. Just sit there and be fully present to this moment and let the moment unfold by itself. But I had to make a decision to not accept the present moment just as it going along, I had to make a decision to show up on my cushion. I had to make a decision to put down my novel, turn off the television. I had to make a decision to change something in order to show up at the Zen Center to sit, to do nothing. And because if I just kind of continued accepting my life as it is, as it was that moment, I would have continued a life of suffering, of challenge, of difficulty. So there had to be some choice to do something different. So it's one thing to have a sense, there's a new possibility, there's something is off here, and to really acknowledge that, to admit it, to see it, that's a big step for some people. And for some people it's huge, the first step of admitting, wow, this is not working. My life is not working as it's going right now. This is not, some people, they don't discover that until they're quite old in life. This is not working anymore. You know, something has to change. So the second step of the journey is to make a decision to change, to start a practice, to move in a different direction, to set out on the journey. And without that setting out, without that decision to do it, there's not going to be anything, nothing's going to happen. And then the third step of the journey, which is usually the long phase of the journey, is doing the practice, walking the path, doing the practice that you've set yourself to do, whatever it might be. There's a lot of different practices that you can do. And those different practices have these different dimensions. There's the obvious, explicit purpose of the practice, and then there's the unknown aspects of how it affects you and what you learn. You go for a stroll in your neighborhood, just to go for a stroll, and you learn about your neighbors and become friends with them. That was not intended, but that was the byproduct. You show up and be present, be mindful, and you learn about yourself in some way. Or perhaps you learn to be present, and to your surprise, it awakens your capacity for empathy. And now you feel much more strongly connected to other people you did before, and now that's changed you. And so that, you know, you have to, and you respond to life based on that change. A lot of the walking of the path traditionally has a lot to do with purification, letting go of attachment, letting go of the difficulties we have, letting go of the attachments, clarifying, purifying our intention, purifying our vision, purifying our ability to see and understand, letting go of how we get distracted, let go of our fear, let go of sometimes our greed, let go of our aversions, our resentments, let go of our guilt, let go of our sense of inadequacy, let go of a lot of things. Learn to let go. There's a lot of that. A lot of that is path we walk on. But also it involves developing certain things, developing certain maybe latent tendencies, capacities we have that are underdeveloped, developing our capacity for generosity or for kindness or for compassion or for patience or for letting go or for discipline, to being committed and keeping the course. I'm committed, I'm going to stick to it and do it. And so that third step is just kind of, you know, once you've made the decision, the third step is to walk the path, engage, do the work. It's sometimes that stage of the path is difficult. Sometimes when you walk that journey, the mountain gets pretty steep, and sometimes the path is pretty flat and it's easy, and sometimes it's downhill, and sometimes it's like a snowball that gets, you know, you're rolling down the hill and it gets bigger and bigger, the momentum builds over time, and it just seems easy, or it's like you finally get into the river and the river carries you, nothing, you don't do anything, the river carries you. Other times you enter the rapids, you better paddle fast. And other times, you know, it's dry and it's uphill. You have to work hard. And there's no way of knowing ahead of time what your journey is going to be. But the different days, different times, different phases, that journeying part has different qualities to it, different aspects, different ways in which it unfolds. And then the fourth stage in this formulation of a journey is having a vision, a clear enough vision of a new way of being, that you can make a commitment to live a new way. So a little bit different than the first kind, where you see it's something else is possible, I want to practice and discover. But this is where there's a clear, visceral sense of a new way, new insight, new way of being in the world. And then a kind of a commitment, I'm going to be this new way. Maybe commitment is maybe sometimes the wrong word. Maybe it's you've a recognition you are now different, and you're going to live from that different way. And sometimes that involves big changes in a person's life, where they decide to let go of a certain job they had, or certain career, or certain activities they were doing, or even a certain way of being, a certain way of seeing themselves. And I had a point in my practice where it became really clear to me that I had a clear sense of what it was like to be alive, to be present, without defining myself, without living with representation, idea, concept of self, of self identity. And I could see at the same time how much I was playing the self-identity game. And I saw that I should let go. It was really appropriate to let go of this clinging to self, this self-identity, representing myself to other people certain ways. And I was afraid to do it. But I really wanted to make that change. So it took a while to kind of make that commitment or make that choice and kind of get myself established to let go and kind of go in different directions, new way. To have this new life that wasn't so self-based the way it had been before. So at some point in the third phase, something opens up for us and we see a new possibility. And then we choose to take that new possibility. That sometimes takes a lot of courage. Sometimes it doesn't take any courage. Sometimes we go kicking and screaming. I don't want to do this. But I don't have a choice. I can't do it the way I did before. So this is the way it has to be now. And then the fifth stage is an interesting stage here. So once there's this commitment to a new way of living, a new life, then there's celebrating that. Celebrating this new life, appreciating it, valuing it. In some places, there's a welcoming. You're welcomed into this new life. You're welcomed into the community of people who are living this way. I don't know if it always has to be community-based, but this celebrating, this acknowledgement, this recognition, yes, this is good, this is wonderful. And I think sometimes in the Buddhist world, this last phase is often not done very much. Sometimes it's done by initiations that people go through. People get initiations where it's, ordination or something, or something is recognized. But something in the heart resonates or gets fulfilled or opens up. Sometimes when we take the time to celebrate or welcome or appreciate the new life that we want to live, the new life that's where we are living. I think sometimes it gets more rooted in us. And so we find in this kind of notion of a journey that has different phases, we find that we are at different points in that journey at different times. And maybe it's sometimes more like a spiral, we come back to the same place over and over again, but different points, and that's, sometimes it's really clear we're feeling something is off here. Sometimes it's really clear that we make a decision, I'm going to devote myself to my practice more. I'm going to start again. I'm going to give it more. Sometimes we're well engaged in practice, and we're just kind of in a long course of just heading out. The journey's been set, and now we know we have to do the walk, and just walking. And then sometimes it's a very clear transition where there's a kind of sense of a new life or a new commitment or a change. Something's really opened up in a nice way. And you can't go back to the way things were before. It's just not possible. I mean, there might be sometimes a pull back there, but it just doesn't make sense anymore. And so there's a kind of a commitment or a decision or a transformation into a new life, into a new way of being. And then sometimes there's the party. There's the celebration, there's the enjoyment. This is really great. Isn't it wonderful? And one of the reasons I think these Buddhist types people don't do enough of the celebration is that celebrating can seem kind of self-centered. It's kind of like, you know, you're supposed to be free of selfishness and to celebrate and enjoy, you know, this new life of mine. I mean, that's back to self again, isn't it? That's the very thing I was trying to get away from, or that's what I did get away from. It just seems kind of like against the grain to somehow celebrate. But beautiful things. I think the heart naturally wants to rejoice in beautiful things. To rejoice. The Pali Buddhist word for rejoice is, and there's a word, anumodana. Anumodana, to feel anumodana, to feel kind of this celebratory or this happiness or this rejoicing. This joy, and these beautiful things that happen. And it's possible to have that for other people and to be so happy, so delighted that person's become selfish, selfless. Selfish. That person's become selfless. Isn't that fantastic? That's like a gift and a wonderful thing to the world. Wow. Isn't that great? But why can't you do that for yourself? Are you exempt from celebrating your own good fortune, because you're selfless? I think then you're just hung up again. I think it's good. I think it's quite, if you're really not hung up and can really feel the beauty and the goodness that's welling up in this heart here, I think there's also rejoicing there as well. You can feel happy with it. So some of these journeys that have these five maybe phases are short journeys, the mini journeys inside the big journey. And some of them are big journeys that take a whole lifetime that you follow along. I think that one way of interpreting Buddhism is that whether we like it or not, we're always on a journey. We're always on some path of change, evolution, because life is not static. Life is always changing. And it's up to you, and there's many possible journeys to take. You could take the couch potato journey, where you spend all your time watching television. That's a journey. As you sit and get more lethargic, fatter, duller, more disconnected with the world around you, and you come to the end of your life and, you know, you just kind of like fade away in your dullness. That's a journey. And or you could take a different journey. You could take the journey of hate politics, and that will affect you in a certain way. Or you could take, there's all kinds of journeys, but it's always a journey, it's always evolution, always changing. Nothing stays the same. And there's a pattern which we set a course. It's inevitable. Even if you don't want to have a journey, if you don't want to change, stop. Everything stop. I just want to be present and accept life as it is and just not have nothing change whatsoever. Impossible. It's always going to be, things are always unfolding. And so the question is, which journey do you want to go on? What direction are you taking? What path are you taking? And it's consequential what you choose. And all of you chose to come here today. That was your journey. And I see this as a very valuable and significant thing to do with your life. And it's a journey of one day. You're probably different now than you were at the beginning, and probably you had variety of things happen in the course of the day that you had to face. But also a day like this is one step in a larger journey of a lifetime, of a life of practice. I know from my own many one-day sittings that I did, my early years of practice, how meaningful it was to sit one days and how meaningful it was to do them over time, month after month, and how the cumulative effect of how they are built and help me with all the different steps of the journey. I think it's very significant for ourselves and for other people that there are people who are willing to come to a place like this and sit and be still and quiet and discover to walk the path here like this. So I say that in my appreciation of all of you and my anumodana, my delight that there are people like you who have the intention and the sincerity, the commitment to engage like this. It's a beautiful thing. You know? Even though I know that for some of you it was not easy to do this. And maybe because of how difficult it can be, challenging it can be, I have even more delight. Not that I'm delighting that you're suffering, but I'm delighting that you would be engaged in a practice to work with that and clarify. And the last thing I'd like to say is that when your journey is the path of the Dharma, path of practice like this, it's not just a matter of, I would say it this way, part of the, a very important part of this, just the Dharma journey is to let there be a willingness to be changed by it. To be open, to be willing, to be changed by it in ways that you can't control, that you can't even expect, you can't even understand how, what's going to happen. Some willingness for something, for you to be not in control of how it unfolds for you. So it's a good path to walk on, and it's a safe path to let your heart be open and willing to be shaped by it or changed by it as you walk. So I hope those comments were maybe useful for you. We have a few minutes before the end. And if some of you would like to ask some questions, we could do that if you'd like. Or we can end and go early. Does anybody have anything you want to ask? Or yes, please.
Thanks. My mind wandered a lot during the day, and I think I need some reassurance that is still a good practice, or that I'm doing it right, or something like that.
Yeah, there's a few other people here. How many people have had their mind wander a lot today? It's definitely part of the path. And in fact, it's a huge part of the path, is to learn to be wise about the mind and the wandering mind. And one of the steps is not so much to control the wandering mind, but to develop a wise relationship to it, have a wise attitude towards it. So the attitude is not one of criticism or discouragement or upset, but to have some realizing this is the nature of a mind. Human minds is generally they wander a lot, they get distracted easily, and maybe even have a lot of compassion for it, because the strength of the mind, that's the strength among being distracted, or the strength about being pulled into different thoughts and concerns, can sometimes be directly related to the very strong forces inside of us. We're trying to make sense of our life, trying to be safe, trying to, make our way through this life. And it might not seem that way when what you're thinking about is dinner menus, but the strength of it comes from some deep place inside. So to have some compassion for that, and to hold that with some care and kindness that might be a huge first step. And then, having that attitude, it's easier then to stop and to look more carefully at what's going on, and to discover more deeply what's really going on here with the distracted mind. It's very valuable to open it up. If we're critical of it and feel like we have to just kind of dismiss it or overcome it by just coming back all the time to the breath, we might not discover what's really needed, what's really going on underneath the surface of that distracted mind. There might be important things to attend to. And then every time you come back from being distracted is a very meaningful time. Every time you wake up and are noticed that you're present is very, very meaningful. And as we like to say, it doesn't matter how many times your mind gets distracted, it only matters how often you wake up, how many often you come back. And every time you come back, you've chosen a different journey, a different conditioning. You've begun to slowly let go of some of the forces of preoccupation that you have. Yes, please.
I'm really surprised at how.
Is this on? You have to make the green button. Just press on that till it's green.
I'm really surprised at how much difference there is coming here and doing this, in how well I can concentrate and in my daily practice. Because it's been getting frustrating, my daily practice, even though I've been doing it every single day. Sometimes it feels like a daydream session where I'm just going through the motions. I'm sitting down for 25 minutes, half an hour, but not getting any focus, or focusing two or three or four times in that time, you know, or something really ridiculous. And then I come in here and I sit down and all of a sudden it's something very, very different. But, you know, it's the same cushion. Yeah, it's the same me. Why is it so different? And how can I take that back into my, you know, daily practice?
I don't know why it's different for you, but there's a few reasons why it's sometimes different for people. Is that sometimes the group helps a lot to sit together with other people. There's a group momentum, a group sense of importance or value, of focus that we pick up by osmosis by people around us. There's a group support. It feels like this is the whole. I mean, they have 30, 40 people in one room doing the same thing. It's kind of like keeps you focused and you know, it's a little bit hard if you're here to start wondering, you know, what's on TV? You know, and even if you had, you know, one of these smartphones, you could look and see what's on TV. You know, here, you're not so likely to do it. I mean, there's kind of a certain kind of subtle, kind, unintended peer pressure. You know, we don't look at our smartphones to find out what's on TV when you're middle of a sitting at IMC. You know, generally, you know. So there's a kind of discipline or sort of kind of sense of focus or something like, this is what we're doing, and we're not going to go off and do something else that supports, you know, being connected and being motivated. So I think the sense of being in a group, for some people, we get carried by the group, we get supported by the group, we get inspired by the group, we get helped with the discipline with the group. There's many things that the group can provide. Also, we pick up from other people, we're inspired by them. Other people are sitting really still near us. And there's a way in which we pick that up, we feel that. And it kind of, maybe these mirror neurons we have or something. And we can kind of like, it's sometimes easier to kind of get into the mode because we get a sense, well, that's what the mode is like. We kind of pick it up from the people around us and, or from the room and the atmosphere in the room. So those are some of the things I think about. And I know some people, one of the things that plagues some people is doubt. They have doubt about the practice. Doubt about the practice is what, you know. But if you come around other people who are motivated doing it, this, you know, less likely to feel doubt. Oh, this is good. You know. So that's what I think. Does that speak to you? Or?
Yeah.
So the question is, how can you bring this, bring all of us with you home?
So just the power of imagination.
I think that, though, what you can do is when you're sitting here with a group like this, take some time to register in some visceral way what it feels like to be sitting in your body, to be present in your body in a group of other people who are meditating. And see if you can have, let it register so there's kind of a visceral memory of what this feels like. And then when you go home to meditate alone, see if you can recall that memory in the physical, visceral way. And maybe that can make you feel more grounded, more connected, more something that helps you when you're on your own. So maybe one more. Yes.
I just actually wanted to add another suggestion about taking that more into your daily practice at home. And I think the more group sitting that you do and retreat actually supports that and becomes easier and easier to do your daily practice and to be more focused in your daily practice.
Yeah. I think so, I agree. The other thing that can help at home, if you're practicing meditating at home, is you can't bring all of us home with you, but you can bring some of the same elements by, for example, having a special place in your home that's designated only for meditation. Some people have something like an altar, and maybe they have a picture of a teacher or of the Buddha or you know, their community of meditating friends or something. So when you sit down, you have the associations and you realize you're not alone. You are practicing together with other people, even though they're not there at that moment. And so you kind of create an environment that replicates and helps inspire you or motivate you in the way that maybe it is when you come here. Okay. So I want to thank you all for coming. And